For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to my favorite episode of the month on the Gray Malkin Lane Show, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. It is the academic panel for the month, and we've been theming the entire month on the show around the incredible character of Thunderbird, or John Proudstar. We opened the year focusing on Krakoa. Into March, we are now jumping into Thunderbird, and there's so much exciting new stuff happening on the show now that we are in the 1970s, and the diversity tapestry is a little bit more profound. I'm so happy to be having five incredible guests that I've befriended through the show, two that I'm meeting for the first time. Let me have everybody introduce yourselves. I'll have you use your name and pronouns. Let us know a little about you, and what are your preliminary thoughts on John Proudstar? Let's begin with the incredible Michael Seache. Michael, welcome to Gray Malkin Lane.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. So, Na'awi, Studenta, hello, welcome. My name is Michael Seache. Those of you that are just hearing Seache for the first time, I'm sure your ears need a break. So, much like I pronounced some Caddo words there at the beginning, my last name, Seache, was originally Seatzi, which would be even harder to say. My pronouns are he and him. I'm from the Albuquerque, New Mexico area, and I've been into comics for about 3,005 years.
Michael, do you want to tell everybody a little about your book?
Certainly. I'm the author of the book is called Native Americans in Comic Books, a Critical Study for McFarland Press in North Carolina. Came out in 2008 or so, and it was a direct result of some research I did at the university and just kind of sat in my drawer for a while. And I realized there was no other first sources. So I figured I, out of guilt, better get that thing published. So because of it, I met a lot of great people like Mr. John Proudstar, we'll meet in a moment, and many others. And I actually was able to, you know, work in the comics a little bit as well. So it's been a fantastic journey.
I was looking very uniquely for a very certain kind of book about natives in comics as I researched for this show, and yours, of course, with that search parameter, like, exactly lit up. You guys should look up Michael's book. It's wonderful, intensely informative, and was a real education. So I'm really happy to have you here. Do you have any initial thoughts on John Proudstar, Michael?
You know, initially, what a complex character. And, you know, when we get into the meat of it and we talk about it, I think we'll find there's a lot to discuss and there's a lot to celebrate. And then as we see, you know, sure enough, there's been revitalizations of story or retelling, but, you know, we just don't have a lot. It's a character that we could have done so much more with, right? So I think there's a lot to talk about, a lot of fertile ground.
And let me also welcome to the show the aforementioned John Proudstar himself. Now, John was on the show a little earlier this month, but some of you may be tuning in just for the trial. John, it's such a lovely thing to have you back for conversation.
My name is John Proudstar. He, him, his are my pronouns. And I'm Basquiaki, Jewish and Mexican. I'm also the creator of Tribal Force, the first all-native superhero comic book in the history of the United States. And some of you might remember me from the television series Reservation Dogs, where I played the father of Willie Jack Leon. I think I was about 8 years old when Giant Size X-Men 1 came out, and I picked it up off the rack, and I was so excited to see a native hero. And I was like, you know, like all of a sudden I'm like, man, there's gonna, you know, he'll have his own comic book someday. And I had all these dreams and stuff about Thunderbird, you know, and then they killed him off 3 issues later, and I was just brokenhearted. And I had sworn, I, you know, as an 8-year-old kid, like, I'm like, I'm gonna bring him back someday. And even if I have to buy Marvel Comics, you know, or buy him from Marvel Comics, unfortunately that never happened. And as I got a little older, I went into the military and ended up going AWOL several times. And on my I think my fourth or fifth AWOL. I had several warrants out for my arrest, and I was in Hollywood at the time, and a buddy of mine and I, we went and auditioned. We're going to audition for movies, and just as they were calling me up to, you know, fill out the forms, my buddy's like, hey, you can't use your real name or your social security because you have those warrants. And I was like, oh my God, you're right. You know, the lady, you know, beckoned to me, and she's like, name? And I was like, John Proudstar. And my buddy was like, where did you get that name from? And I go, you remember Thunderbird from the X-Men? And I said, that's his real name. And he goes, dude, that would be so hilarious if you got stuck with this name forever. And here I am 30 years later. So that's where I got the name. And it was my way of bringing Thunderbird back. It was the only, you know, option I had of bringing him back, paying that homage to that, my original hero as a boy. Yeah. And now that's my name. That's my name legally.
The next three guests are all authors who have told wonderful creative stories. Let me welcome the incredible Marcy Rockwell back to the show. Marcy, it's been a long time. How are you?
I'm doing well, Chad. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be part of this panel. Well, first, I'd like to introduce myself in my people's language. So, Buju, Indigenous Cause, Marcela Rockwell, Indonesianabeo, Manawa, Red River Métis, which is to say, hello, my name is Marcela Rockwell. I am Ojibwa or Chippewa and Red River Métis. I'm a citizen of the Manitoba Métis Federation, which means absolutely nothing in the United States, but there you go. I have been writing professionally. Well, my first professional publication was 1994, and my first novel was published in 2005. It was a Dungeons and Dragons book, and I have been doing a lot of tie-in work since then. That's how I met Ben, and I got to write a couple of Marvel books, and that's how I met you, Chad, so...
Including one on Talisman. Your portrayal of Talisman was wonderful.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It was, there was a lot wrong with how she was written. So I was really, really mindful of portraying her in a way that was more respectful. So I was glad I got the opportunity to do that. And I hope I did justice to her.
I was rereading some comic books from Alpha Flight in that era, and boy, was every character written really horribly. Poor Aurora and like Roger Box. Like it's a uncomfortable era of comic books in some ways. And what are your initial thoughts on John Proudstar, Marcy?
You know, it's hard to look back and see old portrayals of Native Americans and not just cringe and see everything wrong. Like I'm so glad that those characters were there, even if their portrayals were horrible. I grew up reading Alpha Flight, so Talisman was kind of special to me because I lived in Montana, which is South Canada. You know, so we didn't cross the border. The border crossed us. I had her as somebody to look up to in comics, and that was it. You know, so anytime we get an Indigenous character, it's meaningful. So I'm glad that John Proudstar Thunderbird came into being, and I'm hoping that, you know, as I guess he's back now.
Yes, yeah.
So I'm hoping that his portrayal is a little bit more respectful this time around.
I'm kind of wondering if John Proudstar, the person, every time I say, so what's your opinion on John Proudstar? If
I know.
He's going, wait, what are they going to say about me?
No, it's yeah, it is kind of strange.
Let me also welcome the incredibly talented storyteller Ben Rome to the show. Ben, it's so lovely to meet you.
Thanks. It's my first comic podcast, so that's kind of cool.
Well, let's do it again. Tell everybody about yourself.
My name is Ben H. Rome. I am of Eastern Band Cherokee descent. I'm what many call a city Indian, so I have never lived on the res. I have many friends across Native country. I really didn't know my descent until early in college, so it's been an exploration of my culture, my people, for a long time now. Yeah, so, and as far as like comics go, I was a huge X-Force, X-Factor nerd in the 80s and 90s growing up. Been several years since I've gone back through those issues again. So like if you ask that whole, you know, what do you think about John Proudstar? My first snarky answer is he's awesome in Reservation Dogs, because I actually love, I love that series so much. I didn't even realize he was going to be on here, because when I signed on, his camera image wasn't on the reel. I had to slide over, and I'm like, oh my God. It's anyway. So yeah, acting like fanboy. Anyway, but as far as like writing goes, so my first published work was in 1978 when I was six. I had two poems published in my Catholic elementary school newsletter, which was cool. But I've been writing for about 30 years professionally. I'm trying to stick to science fiction a lot, although I've been branching out a little bit with alternate history and looking at just a lot of character-driven stuff. By day, I'm a director of communications for a large trade association in the transportation sector. So, you know, that's where I kind of stick a lot of my roots now. But people would probably know my name best in the gaming world as I ran as assistant line developer the BattleTech war game for about 8 years. And then I actually wrote for them for about 15. So my name is on a lot of this stuff from the 90s, aughts, and early 2010s.
It's fun to hear just how excited you are to be here. Like, that makes me smile. I'm so happy you're here. For those of you that have been listening to our script readings this year, Scotty has been doing the voice of Thunderbird for us on those episodes. Welcome back, my friend.
Thank you, Chad. Hi, I'm Scotty White, he, him. I'm an enrolled member of the Porch Band of Creek Indians here in South Alabama. I'm way far from the rest of the panel, I've learned that. I'm on this side of the Mississippi. So I am a comic book writer. My book is called Chronicles of Limbo, which features a Native American half vampire and her cosmically powered toddler, because that's a market that's not been hit yet. I wanted to bring my people into science fiction and fantasy, and so that's what I did. I own a toy store and a game store here in Mobile, Alabama.
Wow.
My connection with Thunderbird is, you know, as a kid, there wasn't a lot of Native representation anywhere. My first introduction was Spirit from G.I. Joe. I'm a huge fan of Spirit from G.I. Joe in the cartoons, and he got to fight Storm Shadow. I was like, hey, cool, it's a Native versus a ninja. That's amazing. Well, when I got into comics in the 90s, it was Warpath that actually lived. So that's how I kind of learned his tragic ending. And I am looking forward, hopefully, for the future for John, since he's, you know, thanks to Krakoa, he's been resurrected. So I'm hoping that he's not going to become a background character that will actually get some new, fresh stories from him.
Well, that's happening. John is currently being featured in the new title coming out called Weapon X-Men on a team with Wolverine, Deadpool, and Chamber, and there's someone else there. But he is back in his old costume, which is sad because the new David Cutler redesign is so beautiful. And lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. I use he, him pronouns. I am the host of Graham Elkin Lane. I am going to do the like open, awful privilege acknowledgement at the start of this episode. I am the white guy here who is not Native American. I do have a certain amount of love and sensitivity toward Native culture. I am a therapist, as my listeners know, but I have two Native American stepsisters. We didn't grow up together. And for the first several years of my career after getting my degree, I worked for a tribe as a substance abuse and mental health counselor. And it was very transformative into the way that my career shaped out. So it was an entire education, as was researching Thunderbird, because this is a character for a lot of X-Men fans that you just think of as that like martyr guy. But for a lot of fans, he's not the favorite. He's grumpy and he disappears very quickly. But there's a certain legacy for this character that makes him matter a lot. So this month on the show, we've been talking all about John Proudstar. Today, we're going to have kind of a summary of his various stories, talk about his relevance, and put it into a little bit of cultural context. The first episode of the month is the script reading where he died in the comics. And we'll open next month with his funeral. So it's a way to put this character to rest. But he matters a lot. Giant Size X-Men number one took the mutant metaphor from X-Men number one in the 60s over 10 years before and added diversity to the mix. Yes, we had seen an Irish and a Japanese mutant in the original run, but not as featured mutants of the cast. Mutants can be born in any culture, any family. The thing that unites them is that unique X factor in their DNA, making them as the next step in human evolution. This is literally, by the way, what I wrote my senior thesis on in high school, the idea that mutants can come from any culture. And so when the original X-Men were captured by Krakoa, Charles Xavier projected his mind around the planet and recruited a new team. He downloaded English into their brains when necessary, and he gave them code names and costumes. Xavier joined Pyotr Rasputin in asking his parents if he could join the X-Men. He rescued Kurt Wagner from a dangerous mob of murderous civilians, saving his life. He told Aurora Monroe that she wasn't a goddess and that her destiny lies in America, not Kenya. He gave Logan a life away from just being a government asset, well aware of the man's long history as a brainwashed assassin. And then he went to Camp Verde, Arizona, to recruit John Proudstar. The narration, written by Len Wein, tells us, John Proudstar does not like the reservation. He does not like to watch the old ones sitting slumped against their doorsteps, dreaming dreams of glory long gone. John Proudstar is an Apache, and he is ashamed of his people. The Apache were meant to be hunters, warriors, not sad-eyed, simpering, and the word used here is spelled Squaws. It's not polite to say that word. They were meant to run free through the crisp plains grasses, the wind blowing wildly through their hair. Once nothing could stand before the Apache, the bison that covered these plains fell like rain before Apache skill, Apache bravery. But never did any bison fall like this. And we see John Proudstar wearing a form-fitting button-down gray shirt tucked into black pants with a black belt at the middle. His sleeves are rolled up. He's wearing red bracelets and a red headband. And he runs as fast as a buffalo. He grabs it by the horns. He slams it into the ground with a foom sound effect. And he yells,
"There, horned one, do you see? There's still a man amongst the Apache."
When Proudstar sees Xavier in the desert randomly, and this is likely a psychic projection of some kind, because this man is just in his wheelchair in the middle of the desert. Proudstar unfortunately calls Xavier a cripple. He calls him Wide Eyes. He tells him to vamoose. Xavier says, "I've come to help you fulfill your dream, to give pride back to your people. You are special, John Proudstar. You are a mutant, and you are needed." And Proudstar responds,
"And you can stuff a cactus, Custer. A white man needs me. That's tough. I owe him nothing but the grief he's given my people. Now beat it."
"I offer you a chance to help the world," Xavier says, "and you turn your back on me? Then perhaps what they say is true. Perhaps the Apache are all frightened, selfish children." Wow. Proudstar replies,
"That does it. Ain't nobody that calls me a coward, mister. I'm as good as the next guy. Hell, I'm better. You give me a chance, I'll prove it."
Now, just before his inevitable demise a few issues later, this is kind of all we have to work for with John. He's angry. He's tough. He's determined to show he's as strong, if not stronger, than anyone else. He seems to resent his life on the reservation. But if you read between the lines, you quickly realize he's also a veteran. He spent years away from home while fighting in Vietnam. And maybe that anger is earned. Maybe it's not such a misunderstandable thing, even though it does play on stereotypes. The clothing he wears, the buffalo, there's a lot of things that we could talk about, particularly this dialogue between them. And we're going to add the rest of the context that was added later. But let's talk about the introduction of John Proudstar. What are your thoughts and feelings?
So, buffalo, we're in the southwest United States.
The plains, I mean, of the
south. As a detail person, that thing just jumps out at me. I don't know if I ever saw the introduction, so this was like all new to me. But I mean, there's just so much in there that, A, as Marcy would say, cringe, but then also just the details don't jive. And it's just, it's sad to think that so many people even today still have these stereotypical plays when you bring up a character or you talk about an indigenous person, especially in the context of writing. They automatically go to these stereotype pieces, and a lot of that is played out right here.
Yeah, no, that was something we had to endure as natives, you know, that, you know, we were painted with this brush. And it's amazing how they do bring up, oh, they live on reservations, they're in this dilapidated state, but in no place do they give you the reasons why. Do they go into the forensics of, well, they were put on this reservation, all the treaties that were made with these people were broken, and, you know, so you have a better understanding of these characters, of these people that are in that current situation that they were in. It was just swept under the carpet. And being native, and as I grew older and I started to find out the truth, you know, doing the forensics on the history of my people, that's what made me really mad, because there was a feeling of, this didn't happen on accident. They purposely hid the truth from me as a child, from me as a young person in high school, you know, which led to bigger questions of why. Why did they hide the truth? What's so important about these facts that a society, a government is willing to try to bury it?
Some deeply uncomfortable parts of this. I do like Len Wein as a talent a lot. And culturally, times have changed quite a bit. But he introduces all these new characters from different countries with a certain amount of majesty. There's a lot of problematic language used, but in the 70s, the rules were a little different, right? And it was a white guy writing all these characters. When you read Storm's sequence in Africa at the beginning of this comic versus, you know, John's on the reservation, these are the two most uncomfortable ones. Xavier saying what he says to John in a way to recruit him is just one of those 100 things on a list of what makes Charles Xavier an asshole. Now, you can think of Xavier in some ways as being in a rush, right? My students are in danger, so I'm going to say that one thing I pulled from your mind that's just going to piss you off the most and get you to come with me. But just wow, it's a deeply uncomfortable scene. And some of the language that is used in this early sequence really doesn't stand up to the test of time.
The pieces that I love, I think I'll pass on that one because I'm not sure there are any. I love that we have a native superhero. That's great. I'm not Apache, but I don't feel like this is an accurate representation of the Apache people. I live in Arizona. John lives in Arizona. There are no buffalo here. I'm not sure there are even any plains here. You know, there might be some meadows up by Flagstaff. It's sloppy writing. Yeah, I understand the rules were different in the 70s, but yeah. there were no buffalo in Arizona. Well, I don't know. I don't know enough about the Apache, so I can't speak to that. My people were Plains Indian. We did hunt buffalo, but we were up in Montana and North Dakota. So I'm not sure. I don't think it's that hard to do the research. Like, I'm expected to do the research when I write, right? I've done comic books. There wasn't as much emphasis on portraying diverse people accurately, but there should still have been an attempt to get your facts straight.
Sure.
Right.
I think if we look at this story by Len Wein, we can call it a lot of different things, and all of them are accurate. We can see he's trying hard. We can celebrate the diversity. We can call it short-sighted. We can call it culturally appropriative. We can call it problematic, but we can also call it offensive. And I think it can be looked under any of those lenses, and we can both see the sides that are offensive and the sides where you can see what he was trying to do. We have a long-term policy on the show. We try not to call people racist. We try to say that the stories were problematic, which is that delicate balance of trying to analyze history from a modern lens. And when I interview the creators that were writing back then, it's a point that you can tell they get asked these questions a lot, and it's a rough thing for them to reckon with. But I think it's part of what we have to do when we're honoring these characters. There are problems with Thunderbird's introduction, to be sure. The mid-1970s were a time when diverse characters started being portrayed with more regularity and somewhat sensitivity. No longer were the caricatures of the past that had been so long presented to us, although they still were. Not every woman desires marriage and kids, and not every African-American in the comics is speaking in jive talk, and not every communist character is anti-democracy supervillains, and not every Native American character speaks in broken English or wears headdresses or dances around a fire, although they do steal a lot of that in the comics as well. Likely the most prominent character in American fiction at this point, for Native Americans at least, was Tonto, the famous trusty sidekick of the Lone Ranger, who eventually gets his own long-running series in multiple formats. He often spoke in broken English, but he was portrayed to be a very intelligent character who had a lot of deep loyalties and got a lot of story. It has long been the white man's tradition to tell fictionalized versions of classic Native characters that seem to occupy a space like Paul Bunyan in the American vernacular, but they are real people whose stories have been kind of bastardized in a lot of ways. People like Sacagawea and Geronimo, Pocahontas, Crazy Horse. This next section, it is not our job to educate listeners today, but I do think it's important to just let the density and heaviness of things be there very quickly, and that we can delve into it as much as we want. But you have to understand, listeners, particularly my white listeners that have never looked into this, the history of Native Americans post-colonialization is rough and complicated. It is brutal to a degree that is almost difficult to comprehend. Everything that could be done to diminish an entire races and tribes of people was done, from assimilation to culture to slaughter bordering on and stepping into the areas of genocide. Eugenics through sterilization, plans to dilute bloodlines through white couplings, government testings without consent, and while their lands and their rights were taken away consistently, groups were pushed onto reservations, forced to sign contracts that weren't honored, children taken away from parents. Thereafter, that dominant culture starts to paint Native Americans in fiction as drunks and savages, as weak, as unintelligent. They name mascots after them like they are some sort of animal or some fictionalized relic of the past. The brain the chiefs, the Indians, the warriors, the Redskins, the Mohawks, the savages. And these are wars we're still fighting in American culture today. There is no distinguishment between tribes often in fiction. They're portrayed in films for cowboys to do violence against or for white men to harass or swindle or shame. And that still happens in stories today. But there's a long long history of it stretching back into the 17 and 1800s. From November 1969 to June 1971, a group of Native American protesters occupied Alcatraz Island, raising awareness of the plight of natives in American culture. In 1975, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest debuted, and the complex character of Chief Bromden received some powerful attention. In 1971, Tom Laughlin released the film Billy Jack, about a Native American veteran who's an officer of the law on the reservation, who's working to keep the peace where a progressive school has formed. And Billy Jack has very little tolerance for white men who engage in regular hate crimes and then get excuses from the government to continue to do so. This film strikes a really powerful balance between a community of nonviolent protesters and Billy Jack's unwillingness to conform to expectations that violent people do not deserve violent responses. The white men keep escalating their awful threats. Harassment, hate speech, kidnapping, sexual coercion, rape, and murder all take place in this film. And Billy Jack is ready to kick their ass, even if it means sacrificing their life. And there's a template, I think, for Thunderbird that exists in this character, although I'm not sure it's intentional.
Yeah, we were just kind of looking at each other, shaking our heads. So, you know, I really do. And I think that the John Proudstar Thunderbird character actually is intentional, right? To grab onto that milieu, understanding that there is a problem and it is based on culture and it does happen within the borders of America. It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, it was handled well, but, you know, we get a little snippet or a panel or two of background information for each of the characters in the giant X-Men number one, and that's about all we get. But quite frankly, you know, there's a trope there, right? You know, and it carried on to almost the 90s of, you know, from the 70s on. And you're right, you know, the part of it that, you know, kind of splintered it was, of course, the civil rights movement and then the AIM movement, and really sort of bring to light with a big flashlight, you know, that these are cultural injustices that really aren't from history. They aren't something that happened a long time ago. They were happening right in the present day back. I really do agree with us all here. I think that it's really easy to see this character and the introduction of the other characters and really be uncomfortable with it. And that's fine. That's good. But, you know, we talked about Tonto, and, you know, as you said, there's a lot that we can take away from Tonto. You know, I don't love the way he talked. He always gets beat up. But, you know, as a child, as a young viewer of, or reader, if you're reading the comic, either one, Tonto was the one that got the job done. You know, Tonto was the, you know, he was the dependable one. Lone Ranger would be dead like 75 times, you know. We can take that same thing with, you know, the Proudstar and Thunderbird. You know, there are some bad things, like we talked about. Where's the buffalo? I don't know. Maybe there was one out there in Arizona somewhere, and they just thought that. But at the same token, you know, there was that need. There was that need to see that in the borders of America, there's people, our people, American people, Native American people, that really had some injustice and had a right to be angry for some reason. And that trope into the 80s was generically called, you know, the angry Indian or whatever.
When I'm making my show, I constantly am finding little Silver Age stories that I want to write. I'm probably not the guy to write this story, but I think it would be fascinating to do just like a little 5-page feature about that time, like John Proudstar got a buffalo and he like brought it back to his place and then decided to like start wrestling with it. Like, there's just this one buffalo that he brought back to his ranch. He got it from somewhere.
Maybe there are a lot of buffalo in the 616 universe. I don't know. I mean, it is a comic book. John Proudstar is Billy Jack, and in a lot of ways, I don't think there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Billy Jack's a half Apache. Proudstar is a full Apache. Big that movie was in 71. That movie comes out of nowhere, and it's a smash hit. It spawned terrible sequels, but it impacted the culture so much. So of course, when you're writing for what realistically is disposable media, this is what's really interesting about comic books. Is comic books were never meant to be, you know, discussed like we are now. They were here, buy it this month, throw it away, and get the next issue. No one's expected us to be, you know, 40 years later, 50 years later, discussing this kind of stuff. So I understand why Len didn't do his research, because of course he didn't. He was like, this is for kids to read real quick, and then, you know, to occupy them at the doctor's office or something. So, but I 100% see Billy Jack completely in Thunderbird. 100%.
I watched Billy Jack for the first time in preparation for this episode, and I had feelings. I was so frustrated. It kind of captures in an odd way everything that we are feeling in America, like in this era where like rights are being stripped and you're so mad and you feel so helpless and like you feel like you can't fight back. The things that these like white characters were doing and the escalation of it all, I was so stressed out watching it. But it's an odd kind of version of the Xavier Magneto divide in a way, where Xavier wants to play by his weird set of rules and Magneto wants to fight back. And Billy Jack gives a lot of that energy. Does anyone here have a favorite Billy Jack moment or quote? It's an iconic film. Highly recommend watching.
What is it? I'm going to take my left foot and put it across the
room. Yeah.
It's, I'm going to take this right foot and I'm going to whop you on that side of your face. And you want to know something? There's not a damn thing you're going to be able to do about it.
It's pretty fantastic. Highly recommended. I'm going to continue here. Native Americans in film have often been portrayed with mysticism at their roots as well. The feathered hairdress worn by the warrior with the tomahawk or the bow and arrow. The group of men living in teepees doing rain dances, peyote trips. Think back to Disney's Peter Pan and the character Tiger Lily, and then line it up with Pocahontas many years later. And you're going to see some uncomfortable kind of common threads. Both films are important. Both films are intensely problematic at the same time, and you can do that same thing where we analyze history with this lens. I'm oversummarizing so many things here, but this is the landscape in which Thunderbird is introduced. And when you take a swath of the characters that exist in X-Men, from Forge to Warpath to Danielle Moonstar to Talisman and Shaman and on, all of them have this same type of, there's a background related to mysticism for each of them. Even when it's done a little less problematically, it's there for all of them.
Well, it's almost Marvel's attempt to do the Magic Negro. It's their version of the Magic Negro, 100%. So it's like, we can have a spirit guide, or, oh, Forge is great at electronics and mechanical engineering, but oh, he's also a shaman. Yeah, well, of course he is, because we all are, right? Everybody on the panel, we're also all shamans, right? That's our second day job.
You are all storytellers. That's shamanic in its own way.
That's true. I take back my point.
So Proudstar is introduced, as mentioned, with a buffalo on the page. He's angry at some white people and wants to be a true Apache and is concerned about the pride of his people. Later, we see him dressed in a costume and given a code name that relies directly on Native American mythology, almost like he's wearing religious garb or tribal gear or regalia into battle. He's angry. He's a veteran. He's super strong. He's full of pride. He describes himself as having a chip on his shoulder. He's an odd compilation of what's come before, representing the times of the mid-70s in a powerful and somewhat problematic way. He also calls Xavier Custer, which that part to me feels a little fair, frankly. Two other characters that Marvel really pushed to a higher platform in the years before and after Thunderbird are alarmingly similar. Will Talltrees is Red Wolf, who's a veteran caught between the world of the white man and his own people, who's blessed by a native god, Owayodata, and dresses in a wolf pelt and is granted the strengths and skills and speed and tracking of the wolf. Jason Strongbow is American Eagle, who's a veteran caught between the worlds of the corporate white man and his own people. Radiation and or the great spirit of his people endow him with superpowers. It's a weird origin story. He has strength and speed and tracking, and he dresses in a feathered headdress, and he carries a bow and arrow into combat. We are still a few years away from characters like Danielle Moonstar, Warpath, Forge, Maya Lopez, Kushala, Kahori. All these characters are steeped in Native tradition and stereotypes, fringe and feathers and Native gods and the white man's world, but they are done so with so much more sensitivity. Thunderbird's portrayal in giant size sets the trend for this. But for white listeners, I want you to consider briefly the sacredness of your own family's spiritual beliefs. There are things that you don't talk about when it comes to Jesus or whoever you believe in. There are areas that you know are problematic, and it would be uncouth to put it on the page or to say it out loud because it's frankly just offensive. And for so many Native people, those traditions are not honored in that way. Things that are sacred are misappropriated and spoken in ways that they never should be in the first place. Do we want to talk about the mystical connection between superheroes and Native customs? Anyone who'd like to volunteer? Ben, do you want to start this one?
Yeah, there's a lot of different thoughts been running around my head since we started this. So regarding the mysticism aspect. So interestingly enough, a friend of mine, Muskogee, we went on a road trip from Scottsdale, Arizona to Denver, Colorado, because we were going to see Virgil Ortiz's new, at the time it was new exhibition up in Denver. That we drove for almost 2 days in the car, and it sparked a lot of conversation and storytelling between us. A lot of supernatural stories and, you know, just a lot of things that, you know, we experienced growing up. And one of the things that we kind kind of like speared into is like how wrapped into our world is the spiritual aspect. And, you know, if you're a watcher of Res Dogs, you see that almost every episode it's wrapped in there. And it's so natural. It's just, it's part of the fabric of how we live. It's not anything separate. It's not church on Sundays. It's not a Sabbath on Fridays or anything like that. Or anything like that. It's all wrapped around our lives. It's just common. It's not like you have to separate, oh, this is science. Oh, this is spiritual. Oh, this is natural. It's like all these things are wrapped in together and it's just how it works. But to an outsider observer, they take what they believe is extra natural and, you know, assign it this way. And then they look at that aspect of our lives and then they assign it in that direction. And so, but it speaks to a larger thing. As you're talking about all these different stereotypes, I'm realizing as a writer, all are the product of our previous generation. So how we live and how we were raised from our families or our friends or our communities shape in how we believe and move forward in life after, you know, we start adulting. Some of us have never entered adulting. You know, it's part of that process, but it colors how we see things. And so this propagation consistently over the years, generations, you look back at, you know, the first black and whites, you know, 1920s, the stereotypes are they're a lot more blatant there, but it's still carried through even 100 years later in film and television and whatnot, because it's the product of how those people grew up. They then, not on purpose, but how they lived their lives and how they saw things and how they spoke and how they worked and their attitudes and everything carries to the kids. And then that carries to the kids and that carries to the kids. And so as if there's no work being done to educate and to refine and to grow up, then there's no need to change that stereotype look. So like, even when you are going through something, I know myself and friends, we've had these discussions where your first impact or your first thought when you see something is to equate it to something you remember growing up or a thought process, and it's wrong. And you have to stop and correct yourself and like, no, that's not appropriate, or that's not realistic, or that's not really who that person is. And if you don't have empathy built into how you grow up, that trigger isn't hit, and then you're not thinking through how to course correct. Nobody's perfect. We all have to learn to course correct on a daily basis. And it's through, I think, as a writer's job, and I take this seriously as a storyteller, to help people understand those differing perspectives, those differing understandings and ideas, and finding ways to illuminate the audience. You said earlier, the writer of The Origin, you know, he wasn't thinking 40 years down the road we're going to be talking about this and collecting these things, but he was just trying to put it out there in a way that it's a different culture, so therefore, okay, we picked Native, and therefore we're going. But the thing is he's going off all the stereotypes that he grew up with. He probably grew up watching Westerns, sitting with his grandfather, who was probably a World War II vet, and I understand that because that's where I was at, you know, and that family dynamic, and then therefore all those weirdo TV Hollywood-ized versions of the Indian then become encapsulated into how they understand Native. They don't understand it's 567 federally recognized tribes. It's 567 different nations in this country. And that's just by, you know, federal recognition.
And that's just in this country.
Right. And just this country. So, you know, you're talking about the waving grasses of the plains. While I was in Arizona, I didn't see any waving grasses of plains. You know, all these different things. And like, they'll take plains headdresses and put them on, you know, Comanche in the, you know, in the Western serials and all that. So you just see a lot of this misappropriation and misunderstanding. There is a documentary that was done probably about 15 years ago. It's called Real, R-E-E-L, Indians, or Real Indians, I think it was called. Really fascinating. Talked a lot about that, like stereotype appropriating and then just throwing it into a cauldron and calling it a day and not recognizing that each person's individual, each community is important and unique. And that's where we're at now. Good writers these days, the best storytellers are the ones who don't rely on those props to shade the character. They use the character to shade the character. And that is what makes a really good story. And that is how we need to be talking to our kids and to our friends and shaping their world so that they understand that the next time they walk into, they see a smoke shop on Route 66 and they see that cigar in, you know, store Indian and go, oh, wait, that's not, you know, that's not Americana. That's a perverted look at how America was 50 years ago. So, you know, all of that, I'm sorry, it's kind of a word vomit there, but
no, there's a lot to cover, and I appreciate the academic lens.
Yeah. And so like, I do a lot of, I'm very much an amateur film person. You know, I do a lot of film study. I do a lot of discussion about film and stories with my friends. And that's how I become, you know, story building. When you're doing game design and universe building, a huge part of universe building, that backbreaking work that no one ever sees, is constructing the communities and the new ceremonies and all those different things that go into creating a really cool world that is so different, and it helps you understand the perspectives that you're facing when you walk out into the real world. That's why it's right now, with everything that's going on in our time of troubles, it's exceptionally difficult to continue to remember that there are differing perspectives at play. Some are good, some are bad, and that's just how it
goes. Well, one of the very first things about Talisman, Elizabeth Two Youngman, is that she's referred to from the very beginning as Sarcy. Well, that's not the name that her people gave themselves. That's the name that other people who happened to be enemies of her tribe gave to her people. It's actually a slur. Sarcy is a slur. Her people are Tsitsina. So that was one of the things that I made absolutely sure that, you know, I corrected immediately. Like, I wasn't even willing to write the character until the editors understood that we were not referring to her as Sarcy ever. Just there are so many different things. There's so many different ways to approach the topic more sensitively. Like that's not my tribe, right? And ideally, in an ideal, perfect world, a Tsitsina writer would have been writing her character. But I don't know that there are any who, you know, have the connections to get that job to write that story, you know?
You don't have inherent cultural knowledge of all 600 tribes out there, Marcy?
No. 574 federally recognized tribes.
What's wrong with you? How do you not know about every single tribe?
I know. I'm a bad Indian. I'm sorry. But yeah, in a perfect world, that's the way it would be. And I felt a huge burden as a Native American person trying to write about a tribe that wasn't my own. Like, I don't even know my own tribes, all of our traditions, because the Ojibwe in Minnesota are different from the ones in North Dakota, are different from the ones in Montana. And even in Montana, the ones in Northern Montana are different from the ones in Central Montana. You know, you still have a responsibility to do the very best that you can.
Of course.
I also just wanted to say, Ben was talking about the whole mysticism thing. Like, I actually think that that's something that white writers get right on accident. Because, as Ben was saying, you know, that's part of our worldview. The indigenous worldview, for the most part, is not like a top-down pyramid with man at the top and then animals and plants in the earth, right? It's a circle. We are all equal. People are equal to plants, are equal to animals, are equal to the earth. And it's our responsibility to take care of the four-leggeds, and, you know, that everything has a spirit. Like, that's part of the indigenous worldview in most places on this planet. So, like, white people who don't understand that point of view are going to view it as mysticism.
Yeah, you know, in the Marvel universe, there's a whole thing about magic. I want to do a whole month on Marvel magic one day. There's an entire encyclopedia to delve into here. Doctor Strange draws upon, like, other entities by making little bargains and speaking spells and opening things
up. Right.
And that's almost how they treat Native American characters in the Marvel universe. There's some sort of communion with a god figure. And, you know, the Native god Oweyadada that I just mentioned is akin to Odin in Asgard in its way, you know, or something like that, which makes the cultural traditions, I think, less special because they are real and they're based on real things. We have talked about this on my show in context with the flesh-eating character in Canada whose name starts with a W, but we don't say that name on this show, and how that's very problematic because we just think of it as a horror character, but it's a sacred tradition or structure for others.
Yeah, with Tribal Forest, that was one big considerations that I had, was because the group is dealing with gods. You know, Thunder Eagle is a god, and he's got to come down here and deal with humans, and he's not very nice when it comes to humans. And, you know, some people would say, oh, he's kind of cruel, he's kind of this and that. And I said, well, that's the relationship we had with some of our gods that we had encounters with. They're not here to teach us. And sometimes the teaching is hard. Sometimes the lessons are hard. And sometimes they have to be the obstacle in your way as opposed to anything else. So that's their responsibility. They don't come down here to coddle and cajole for our lessons. But one of the beautiful things that I saw on Reservation Dogs is we were shooting on this, I think it was the third season, we were shooting on in a cemetery. And our first day there, you know, we're setting up, everyone's getting ready. And then Casey Camp Hornick comes out with some sage and an eagle feather and just starts doing a blessing ceremony. And immediately all the natives line up so she can smudge them, you know, with this sage. And the non-Indians were like confused. They're like, what's going on? You know, it just happened organically. It wasn't like they said, hey, come over here. We saw it. We responded to it. And then when the non-natives wanted to know what was going on, we had to explain to them like, well we're in a cemetery and we just want the spirits to know that we're here in a respectful way and that we'll behave in a respectful manner while we're here. And they thought that was so beautiful. And they wanted to know, can I go up there? And we were like, yeah, you can get smudged. Of course you can. But they just thought the beauty of it was how we all responded automatically and that there wasn't a thought, there wasn't a call to action. It was just something that we knew innately that we wanted to show the spirits around us that we were going to be respectful of this property that we were being allowed to film on. And it made me really understand white people a little better in that moment because I was like, man, they don't have this component and we do. And it was a sad thing and a beautiful thing in the same moment to share that with non-natives and for non-natives to see our culture in the true way that it is, that this is how we walk. We are constantly in two worlds. There is no church on Sunday. It's church every day. Our relationship with our spiritual is a constant. It's not just for Sundays. You go to church and you dress up and clean up and you promise God you're going to be good for the rest of the week. Ours is an everyday thing, you know, where I think one of the speakers here said saying we're constantly recalibrating, you're constantly checking yourself to do better, to be a better human being. And I'll never forget that moment from Reservation Dogs.
I worked among the Coeur d'Alene tribe in northern Idaho for years, and there's a strong presence of like the Jesuits there. There's like old trading posts and religion on the reservation itself. The first funeral I went to when I was there was in this kind of old Jesuit church that had a lot of carvings in it, but they opened with the smudging and the hand drumming. I was moved to tears, and ever after, like, hand drumming became my favorite thing. But I was so pleasantly surprised and kind of flummoxed by the mix of the traditions together and how that was so perfectly embraced by everyone there, even though it was uniquely that place. You know, I think it's such a beautiful thing. But when we try to put that into writing and we make it superheroes or gods powering up mortals, it's not the same.
Go back to, I have a degree in Native American Studies from the University of Oklahoma. And because of that, I have a lot of, you know, different sort of ethnographic and sort of, you know, the different ways of looking at culture. And it reminds me, you know, the way that ethnographers would typically look at, you know, the other culture, if you will, would be looking at their ceremonies. And they would use that word ceremonies, the people that were doing the studies and such. And they would talk about how that demarcates in that culture something internal. And you know, the idea, I guess, for a non-native person or a person not in that culture would be the idea of like graduation, like it's a physical embodiment, it's a public embodiment of an intrinsic change into, you know, not being in school or being in adulthood. So as they, you know, as we're hearing, right, that separation of, oh, it's the event and the intrinsic is something that I feel like in many Native cultures, many Native tribes and communities there's not that division, right? There's not that division between the public and the internal, between the difference between song and song that, you know, helps you in a journey or helps you in a task or helps the community, you know? And that's kind of interesting in some ways to me is the idea that, as you say, and as John, as you were saying, you know, maybe I understood these white people a little bit better, but in that respect, you know, I saw a lot of that approximation of meaning in many times, and that sort of really hit home is that, you know, in many ways, depending on the tribe or the community you're talking about, it's inherent, you know, like John was saying, like everybody just knew to go over there, probably because everybody's grandma at some point said, yeah, get over there, you know, but John and I just do what grandmas say, right? So
yeah.
At the same time, right, we don't have that separation that other people do, or at least for some reason there's that veil for some reason, and people don't, you know, especially like the people that are doing ethnography and that sort of, I don't mean to pick on anthropologists or anybody, by the way, but it's just that type of like trying to meticulously explain something that everybody else knows for whatever reason.
For my many, many anthropologist listeners, please feel free to send in your angry feedback and I will pass it on to Michael.
Open a can of worms there, Michael.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
John Proudstar's name is Thunderbird. It's implied that Xavier chose it for him, just like he picked John's costume initially. But many years later, we get a story in X-Force Minus One, where John is home on leave from the Marines, and he's visiting with his parents, Neil and Maria, and his grandfather. They live in Arizona in Camp Verde, which is a fictional place related to some places that exist, is an easy way to phrase that. His little brother James is also there. And in a private moment, John opens up to his mom about a sacred experience he had while he was overseas in combat.
I wanted to look at the stars and finally where they ought to be. When I was stationed overseas, everything was turned around. Never felt comfortable like I belonged. You know, man, I almost didn't make it back. I never told you because I didn't want you to worry. We were skirting a thunderstorm on our way back to Guantanamo when the storm shifted unexpectedly. Lightning hit one of our engines and we nosedived into the Caribbean. I managed to get the pilot and myself into a lifeboat, but the waters were tough. I figured we'd probably drown before anyone could rescue us. Then suddenly, the sky opened up with a roar of thunder and I saw a great bird of lightning above me that signaled the storm end. I knew everything was going to be okay. But Grandpa say I finally found my totem. Oh, don't cry, Mom. I'm here, right? We Proud Stars are survivors.
It could almost be believed, based on the art, that John saw the Phoenix Force. But he's never quite connected to an actual god or tradition. But his name selection, Thunderbird, is connected to some belief systems that exist in certain indigenous traditions. Though I don't think in the Apache tradition, at least not based on my own short-sighted research here. Although this is really funny, I did a lot of searching for Native American things in fiction. Multiple times my fingers were too fast and I would accidentally type naive Americans in, which yields very different search results. It's like when I try to type Alpha Flight, but it always comes up Aloha Flight. The Thunderbird symbol is often represented by the great winged bird, one who beats its wings and creates thunder and lightning. The symbol stands for being a protector of the people. And this experience adds to a gorgeous context to John's first appearance. He is Thunderbird. The emblazoned bird he saw stands boldly on his costume's chest, again on the belt. James Proudstar, known as Warpath, originally took that Thunderbird name and costume to honor his brother. And he later got a massive tattoo of a Thunderbird on his back in that like X-Force 90s run by Adam Pollina. The third guy that was Thunderbird was Neil Shara, who is from India, and that one makes much less sense. The suit that John wears is black and red and covered in fringe, and it's made of unstable molecules. And John wears feathers in his hair and a black domino mask. He's part of a military unit again, this time a superhero one. And in Giant Size X-Men number 1, Thunderbird, just from a few years ago, post-Krakoa, this one is by Steve Orlando, Nyla Rose, and David Cutler. And by the way, the final episode this month, everybody, is an interview with Steve Orlando and David Cutler. They give us a brand new redesign for Thunderbird, taking all we know about this character and expanding it. John has Jumbo Carnation design him a new costume. He chooses red and black and yellow with white to represent three of the four directions, knowing that he can choose the fourth later. But he also chooses the color turquoise. And there's a beautiful text page about all of this, but here's one line from that.
To me and a lot of my people, the native people, turquoise means strength and skill, power, and invincibility, all coming from within.
In the new Weapon X-Men promos that are coming out, and the first issue was just released before we record this, John is back in his classic Thunderbird gear, but it is exciting to to see him on an X-Men team, although I really wish he was in the new David Cutler costume. It's so beautiful. Scotty, do you want to talk to us about your feelings on John's costume or his connection to the Thunderbird Phoenix Force?
Well, as a Marvel fan, I kind of wish it was the Phoenix Force. That would make a little bit more sense. But it's funny, especially after we've done read through Giant Size X-Men number one, Xavier names him Thunderbird. He's clearly not happy with it. He's not happy with any of the code names, anybody. Anyway, he's clearly continuing not to call Cyclops Cyclops. He calls him One-Eye throughout his run, in that early run. He's not happy about any of this, and he's not having it, and I kind of respect him for it. Put on the costume, because, you know, of course, he's got to wear something, and it was the 70s. He didn't get to pick it. They drew it on him. And I guess he was damned if he did and damned if he don't.
John, take us back to 9-year-old you seeing Thunderbird's classic costume for the first time. Do you remember how you related to it as a kid?
Oh, my God, I loved it, you know, because it was, you know, it was superhero stuff. It wasn't, you know, I understood very young that, you know, superheroes were a genre that was just a whole part of the game. You know, like, yeah, you have to have a superhero suit and it's got to be flashy and stuff like that, just like all the other heroes had flashy costumes. So I loved it and I continued to love it. You know, I was like, man, I wish we could get rid of the fringe. That would be great. And the new iteration, I didn't like it at all. I didn't like the new iteration. I actually wrote to one of the guys and just pleaded with them.
Well, so you prefer the old costume.
Yeah. And I said, you know, listen, I go, how about this? How about we just take the top of the old costume and keep them in, you know, your new jeans and combat boots and, you know, but just have a little homage to the old way. But none of this flashy stuff. They keep wanting to throw feathers on us. And, you know, that was one big rule, Tribal Force. I was like, I would always tell the artists, no feathers. And they would want to know
Danny
why.
Danny Moonstar loved the feather, though.
And I would say, well, the feathers are earned. And each tribe has certain ways to earn those feathers. So until we figure out why they're earning the feathers, they're not going to have those on there. You know, people always go towards the powwow gear. You know, they look at what the powwow dancers are wearing and they're like, oh, let's put that on a hero. And it's like, no, that has nothing to do with what they're doing. That's powwow. That has nothing to do with going to war and different things of that nature. So again, they're still misinterpreting our ways, you know, and the things that are important to us and how to implement those.
I think the problem with the costumes in both of the costumes is that it only focuses on one aspect of who John Proudstar is. Yes, John Proudstar is an Apache, he's a Native American, but he's an American. He's a Vietnam vet. He's an X-Man. He's a superhero. But no, we're just going to focus on the one thing. So let's give him fringes and feathers and like, it's good to have an identity, but he's more than that. We are all more than that. What comics miss is that point. They want to hone in on just the one aspect, especially when someone who's dealing with like us, who are the other in the story. They just want to focus on what you know. Oh, you're all familiar with that. So we're just going to do that and not really explore any of that. And it comes down to even something as simple as this costume. We're just going to do regalia for him, and which is highly inappropriate. But again, no one did research back then. That's what it is. But
yeah, I think, you know, that really, thank you, Scotty. That really kind of spurred me on. You know, what I was thinking about is compared to, say, when we were talking about the limited ability of the original writer to talk about, say, you know, those other aspects of John's life, of Thunderbird's life. And I use that specifically because I'm thinking about like Colossus. You know, we see a tiny moment of his farm life. I believe there's a tractor involved that he, you know, instantly gains his power. Maybe that was his origin story. But we see little tiny snippets. But, you know, for like Aurora and Colossus, they don't have, at least from my perspective, they don't seemingly have the visual one-track mind, if you will, of just their culture. Now, you can, I see what you're saying. Like, I really like the, you know, Thunderbird's costume, if you want to call it a costume as well, right? And I really like vibrancy. I'm glad it wasn't leather, that, you know, like... fringe and feather. But, you know, we don't necessarily see that with Colossus. There's nothing like that says, you know, that his costume is Russian, if you will. There's nothing for here and there for Aurora that says like it's specifically African, if you will. So, I liked it, but I think there's a miss there as well, right? I think like Scotty was saying, there's a little bit one-track mind of going, well, we're just going to pick one thing and we're going to celebrate that.
Yeah, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about how we're carrying forward perspectives. So, like, you know, it's basically the comic book writers and the artists time, mostly white guys. If it's like Cyclops, who's, you know, his whole thing is It's all about his visor. That's what the costume is based on, you know, centers around. So it's all about the one thing. Wolverine is the claws. You know, even Colossus is the steel suit or the steel looking suit. But then you get into minority and underrepresented. And if it's a woman, it's the low cleavage cut. If it's native, it's feathers and fringe. If it's a black person, it's, you know, they're muscular everywhere. And, you know, with the black eyes, it's the afro or the, you know, show off the chest hair.
We talked a lot about blaxploitation's impact on comics last summer on my show.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's all about the point of view of the people involved and where that's coming from and how they're seeing things and not opening themselves up as a storyteller to incorporate the more nuanced facets of things. So the flip side would be, so the question that I probably get from somebody like my wife would be like, so how would you better represent, in this case, John Proudstar in a costume that focuses on who he is as a character and not as a one track statement based on something that's stereotypical. So like, that's a good thought exercise. Like, how do you present that? What is the better way to focus on that? And that's, you know, I'm not saying that we have to answer that question here, but that's what we want to think about. If something looks odd to you or looks really kind of cringy, think about where the aspect is coming from and then look and ask yourself, how would you interpret this or present this in a better way?
What's really interesting is like, both of them are just products of their ontologically. So, you know, they have what
it's Dave Cockrum and Peter Iroh.
What we've already discussed that they've had their influences old pulp comics, cowboy and Indian movies and things. And so they just only know, plus they also get the stuff from the late 60s, early 70s. So you have the American Indian movement, the hippie movement, those things that are constantly in the media, like we mentioned, Billy Jack. The interesting problem that this creates is that goes on for generations. And when it goes into all the way to Krakoa, when Thunderbird gets a new costume, he still has fringe on it. It's still fringe. And it's still those elements that, would he actually pick that? It's a question they don't ask for it. They don't even think to ask. And it's written, you know, it's got native writers on it, and it's still, it's because it's just so deep in us and over the generations, it's going to take a long time for it to come out of us anyway. But those seeds are sown back in the 70s for this character in particular, and just kind of, even though he's not been around, but you know, he comes back, you know, with his brother. His brother takes the same costume, and then his new coat, he picks the name Warpath for Pete's sake. And so, you know, those things kind of fester and grow, and to the point where we just find it acceptable today.
It's lazy shorthand, right? It's feathers and fringe is Indians, face paint, Indians, the drums, Indians, whatever, you know. Even
the bow and arrow in the hand of every, or the tomahawk, or the, yeah, like, right. it's so consistent.
The turquoise.
Turquoise. Well, you know, there are people who want to be Indian. That's in Arizona, a lot of people wear turquoise. I see it more on white people than I do on native people in Arizona. But
yeah.
I was, one of the things that struck me in what we were talking about is the choice of red, black, and yellow with white to represent three of the four directions. That's bizarre to me because the four directions are red, black, yellow, and so I'm not sure where that came from. Like, that's such a simple thing. And to get it wrong, right? Like in not all, I'm not, obviously, I can't speak. I, as John said, I don't know all of, you know, I'm a bad Indian because I don't know everybody's traditions, but for most of the tribes in on Turtle Island in what we call the United States, the four directions are represented by red, white, black, and yellow. I believe the Navajo also used turquoise to replace one of those four colors. But to say that, I don't know, that those are three of the colors and then he's going to choose the fourth later. It's like even that basic thing is misunderstood. And it's just so lazy. That's all. Like this would, like it bothers me because I'm native and my culture, not Apache, but you know, generally speaking, as an indigenous person, it's being misrepresented. But it really bothers me as a writer. Like, if it was anything, and I was reading it, and it was such a simple thing to get right, and I'd be like, it would take you 5 seconds to look that up. What is wrong with you? Like, that's a throw the book across the room moment for me.
Sure.
And
I just don't think they're aware enough to make that choice to check. They're just not aware. It's, you know, this is what I know and this is how it is. And they don't, that's fact, right? Of course it's fact. And then they just write it down.
I mean,
yeah, but there's a responsibility no matter what race you are.
Yeah, exactly. 100%.
Absolutely. There's a responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, it's just lazy writing. I mean, it doesn't matter what, even if I was writing a story that was all about white people, like like if it was in a state that I didn't live in a town I didn't live in, I would have to do some basic research, right? We have standards.
Okay, we're going to do a quick recap of Thunderbird's history in comics. After Giant Size X-Men number one, we see John joining the team in X-Men 94. He butts heads with Cyclops, who is younger and not a veteran. John gets hurt in the danger room in a training exercise, and he gets embarrassed, especially after Cyclops yells at him in front of the others. Other stories will show that the X-Men trained together for a period of weeks, but in the original comics, it just seems like a couple of days. Refusing to be sidelined, John then joins the X-Men in facing the threats of Count Nefaria and the Animen in the NORAD base in Colorado, literally saving the world from potential nuclear war. But when Nefaria was escaping in a ship, Proudstar wanted to prove himself and jumped on the ship, punching it until the ship explodes. We learn later that Nefaria escapes through teleportation, but John is dead. He didn't make it out of the mission. And something we often forget about, Xavier, who retroactively was a veteran who experienced the deaths of soldiers telepathically, is now the general in this war with an army of mutants, and Thunderbird is his first soldier that dies. And Xavier is in his mind when it happens. It specifically states, you know, John is dead, but Xavier has to continue to live with the pain. For many years, John falls into a category with characters like Bucky and Uncle Ben and Gwen Stacy. He was the martyr that you can never bring back. The memorialized character is occasionally referenced as a casualty. They name a ship after him, or there's a base somewhere with his name put on a plaque. We see him in photographs. But Claremont picks up the threads with James Proudstar, a young mutant member of the Hellions, who takes the name Thunderbird while working for Emma Frost. He goes after Xavier in an infamous issue, trying to get revenge for the death of his brother, but ends up choosing a life of... Then there's a really rough Rob Liefeld story right at the end of the New Mutants run, where James goes home and his entire reservation has been massacred. His parents and everyone are dead, and then he calls himself Warpath and goes after the killers for many years. A few years after this is when we see the book Exiles get launched, which is when they brought alternate versions of the X-Men to hop around different realities, and there's a John Proudstar featured quite prominently in this run from another universe who's powered up as a Horseman of Apocalypse, and he's a pretty fun character. Claremont also explores John's early days with the X-Men and his kind of need to prove himself in a few backup stories in places like Classic X-Men. We've reviewed some of those on my show this month. He also gives us a beautiful story called Mourning in Classic X-Men 3, where we see James Proudstar has taken his brother's corpse to give him a proper burial. You've heard these on my show, so we won't take a long dive here, but we do learn several facts about John that have never quite been stacked up in one story. Number one, he lied about his age to join the military early. Number two, he's eager to prove himself in a big world off the reservation. Three, we get hints to the fact that he has lost some folks and experienced some major traumas overseas. Four, he was a corporal before his discharge from the military. Five, one of his leaders in the military was Thunderbolt Ross, you know, like the Red Hulk played by Harrison Ford in the last Captain America movie. And apparently this was the only guy John could stand, because maybe they're both grumpy together, I don't know. The next thing, John's dad is also a veteran. We also get reference to John having an Uncle Jack, who's a man that sacrificed himself at some point to save John, and I have to wonder if that's a direct Billy Jack reference somehow. There's a lot of history that could be explored about his early life, his parents, what his life was like, how his powers manifested, etc. In the aforementioned X-Force Minus One, we also get Thunderbird's most resonant story, perhaps. He's on leave, he learns his mother's being treated for cancer by some asshole named Dr. Edwin Martinick. It turns out this guy is lying to Native women and Native people, falsely diagnosing them with cancer so that he can experiment on them, trying to create mutations or mutants. This man also mutates himself into a creepy coyote guy. John gets to wrestle a tiger at a fair and then also expose Martinek's crimes, reflecting on the painful and unfortunate real-world history of white people experimenting on Native Americans, which is more extensive than you think. In Giant Size X-Men 3 and 4, we learn about the John's Camp Verde tribe are the Chiricahua Apache, which is a real people, so Claremont has now given him an official tribe. In the early 90s off-panel, again, is when we see that entire tribe massacred, and James spends years investigating it before we learn Strife did it. That fucker, Cable's evil clone from the future, who's the biggest Phantom of the Opera villain. The worst thing he ever did, perhaps, was murder this tribe off-panel, which is just an unfortunate story. When James finally gets to avenge his people, he sees John's spirit guiding him and makes peace with his family in the afterlife. We also see John back during the Necrotia event, animated by Celine with Detector Organic Virus, and James has to kill him before defeating Celine because John's being controlled. He's back again with more prominence in the very short limited series Chaos War X-Men 1 and 2, where he and other dead X-Men defeat a big old demon called the Carrion Crow, and John calls upon the Thunderbird during this fight. And again, it seems like the Phoenix Force, but it doesn't quite say it. Finally, during the Krakoan era of comics, John has been resurrected. He's the first to pass through the waiting room. He lives in a new life in the new world. We see him beautifully reunited with James in a scene written by Vita Ayala in New Mutants. It's so wonderful. And then John is helping James deal with his deep guilt about being a survivor. We see John in his own issue where he gets to meet his grandmother, Lozen Proudstar, who is a very angry, proud woman who lives on a different reservation. And she ends up kind of helping him form a commune for mutants that don't have homes for a period of time. We see him fight Edwin Martinick again, because again, Native kids and Native mutants are being experimented on. Thunderbird actually like kicks ass like a pro wrestler, shirt ripped off, like wrestling with things in this giant size X-Men Thunderbird issue. We also see him in action in X-Men Red, in Sword, and in the X-Men Unlimited Infinity comic, where he gets to save a bunch of mutant children and has a really fun, brutal like wrestling match with Cruel the External, that purple guy with that spiky ponytail. He's a ridiculous character, but it's really fun. He's now slated to be in this new Weapon X-Men team, so hopefully we'll see him enter more prominence than ever before. Also, fun fact, you remember how Mr. Sinister is a shapeshifter and he took his powers from the character Courier? In the Krakoan era, we learned Mr. Sinister got his super strength from John Proudstar's DNA. So, as always, fuck that guy, but it's kind of an interesting connection to one of X-Men's biggest villains. What are your thoughts on this kind of interim history for John? What is there to explore? What stands out to you as kind of interesting when we read between the lines of this character?
Well, one of the first things that jumps out at me is the whole plot point experimenting on the Native people. There's one issue of misrepresenting Native people and not doing your research. But there's another thing, appropriating our trauma for entertainment. And when white writers write about things like the sterilization of our women and residential schools and the MMIW epidemic, and they're not doing it with sensitivity, they're doing it purely for entertainment or shock purposes or for trauma porn, you know, that is something out of all of the things that you could find to be offended about as a Native person. For me personally, that is one of the things that is really hard for me to take.
Yeah, Black history and Asian American history in comics are often very similarly treated. Kind of the bastardization of Japanese culture in the X-Men happens over and over again and in a similarly disrespectful way.
Yeah, because these things are ongoing. Like, we live with intergenerational trauma. We live, like, there is not an Indigenous person on this continent who has not been touched by the horror of residential schools and assimilation. So when people write about those things because it's interesting to them or they think it would make a good plot point, and they're not understanding that this is something that is still hurting people to this day, you know, that's offensive. The same thing with the, you know, experimenting on Native people, on Native children. That's how we got the food pyramid, you know, or the nutritional guides. They experimented on Native children, malnourished them to try and figure out how much of each thing you needed. And so, like, you're using our pain, and yeah, it's just one more way of brutalizing us. And yeah, so when I see, you know, there's annoying and, you know, bad writing. And
then there's offensive.
And then there's offensive. And that falls square in the offensive column for me. So
it's interesting in the lens of the mutant metaphor. So often they're trying to equate the idea of mutants as disenfranchised individuals who are going through these things. But this isn't a story. The one we're talking about is not a story about mutants specifically. It's a story about Native Americans. This like off-panel genocide and then the experimentation story repeated multiple times. It's brutal. That's a rough thing. There is an acknowledgement on the page that this happens in the world, but the acquisition of the trauma for storytelling purposes is uncomfortable when it's not done by the right people.
Yeah, so like I said at the beginning, I haven't followed a lot of X comics for many, many years. So going through this, the whole litany that you had summarized there, it was like, I wasn't aware of it, pretty much any of that stuff. But I will say what did perk up my ears was a New Weapon X-Men team with Wolverine, Deadpool, Chamber, and Cable. Those were some of my favorite characters from way back when. So seeing this as a possible new team up may actually pull me back into...
Despite Thunderbird's lack of extensive history, Thunderbird does have a funny relationship with Wolverine, who he's trying to always one-up himself with. And in X-Men Red, he has a very sassy, in-your-face relationship with Cable specifically. So there's some fun dynamics with these characters, actually. Also, Cable was the one that like took his little brother and made him a soldier, right? Like there's some interesting dynamics if the writer gets it right.
Which is great. And I think that's where I would like to see, like, moving forward is as Marvel adopts into this new way of storytelling with multimedia now and with the whole multiverse thing setting into place where pretty much you could tell any story at any time, you know, it'll work. I mean, look, we're in Fantastic Four in the 60s. I mean, come on. But I think what really speaks now, you know, as Marcy was saying, the institutional trauma that's been the standard trope, we can move away from that and going into what makes the character and not that one-dimensional thing that drives, you know, whatever the plot or the costume or the saying, you know, their catchphrase or whatever it may be, and start looking more at intricate stories that tell the beauty of their community, their character, and their family. So like look at Kahori in the What If Marvel since it was fantastically done. I look at Echo. I loved that. I know a lot of people panned on the Marvel live action, but I really loved it because it tied into the community so well, and it talked a lot about the dynamics and where you get a really good understanding of Echo as a person and how she fits in all of that dynamic, working with both Kingpin and then on her own, and understanding where, you know, Hawkeye was and you know, Kate Bishop were coming from in their space. So I think that's where the storytelling really should go into, because the character in the community is what makes us as a people strong and resilient, not the traumas, not the stereotypes, not any of that stuff. We're looking at that with African-centric storytelling in other ways, even just outside the comic space. And there's such beauty and awesome ways to talk about that, those cultures. Why can't we do the same here instead of relying on the same old?
Yeah, I think Marcy and Ben have a fantastic point. In fact, I'd like to jump in a little bit and chomp on it a little bit more. And that's, you know, I think Vine Deloria talked about it in his book, Custer Died for Your Sins, where he talks about, you know, everybody's wanting to always know, everybody non-Native, of course, wanting to know what he called the Native plight. And that would be that sort of like that same story we're hearing of, yes, there were atrocities, and yes, there are atrocities. But rather than focus on that, Vine Deloria also coined a phrase in that book that I typically like, which is, you know, Native or Indian humor. Or in Oklahoma, it's called Indian humor. But the thing is, you know, that's our survival skill. So I always like to suggest that as a something that's missing. It's outright missing. And I would say 98%, 99% of the comics that I see that portray Native. Because quite frankly, the atrocities are the reasons that we use humor. And we use it quite well as a shield, as a, you know, as a battlefront in order to help. And quite frankly, I think we could almost see some of that. Especially, Scotty, you were talking about, and I forgot, but you're right. Like, you know, he calls Cyclops One Eye, and he calls, you know, Xavier Custer, which is quite fitting as well, right? So I think there's a chance to someone to really inject some of that wry Native humor, indigenous humor, and it really go far. And really, I find, and John, you know, back me up if you, but I find Native humor to be universal, right? So if I'm with a bunch of Native people, indigenous people, and we're joking around or whatever, that can be contagious, right? That's universal. Like other non-Native people will join in and also, you know, want some of that humor as well. So I would love to see more actual humanity, and that humanity includes the humor of Native Americans.
Yeah, if I can say something, that's where I think Reservation Dogs was really successful, is that it was the first time it showed a Native community and the massive amounts of humor that we have. And that was so universal with every tribe here in America. That was a universal quality of us, is that we have our humor. That's something that everyone never gets, or they don't want to include in the painting of us. But that's who we are. And we all relate relate to that. And it was so great to see that, to finally see us being funny and humorous and along with the other, you know, sides of us. But yeah.
Excellent, excellent thoughts. Very thought provoking. And whenever I do these episodes, I'm left feeling a certain way. It's a whole education in a lot of ways, but we kind of create a certain energy as we're outlining the stuff that's very problematic next to the stuff that has potential. But this is a character that's kind of never been given that potential. He represents a new possibility, a new set of possibilities, a new generation of what could be. But I'm also getting the vibe that we're kind of erring on there. There's a longer list of problems than there is successes for him. Something to be celebrated and something to very fully understand what has been done wrong for so long. The X-Men is one of the few areas of superhero comics that has a lot of different Native characters, but again, all of them have at least the vibe of this one. But particularly that like genocide of the tribe off panel, that's the one that just like gets me right in my stomach. It's so poorly executed, and then the character goes on the warpath afterward, and he's still using that name even though he's an amazing character. I love the character of James Proudstar. I may or may not have had a large crush on James Proudstar in the late 1990s as a reader of the comics. So as we're wrapping up, I would love to hear kind of any final thoughts. How are you feeling? How are you vibing? I hope this is a space of safety, even though we're also touching into things related to generational trauma and topics that are kind of sore. These like stick in our teeth, right? It's one of those things I imagine as you read superhero stories and see such a deep history of this being so poorly done. When we talk about it, it kind of brings that energy to the surface too, which is a painful thing to reckon with, even though it's a lovely thing to discuss. So I'd love to hear any final thoughts. And as we're wrapping up our thoughts, is there anything you'd like to plug related to your individual work, and where can people find you if they would like to follow you?
Yeah, I appreciate that. So first of all, fantastic, and you know, some of you I know and some of you I don't, so thank you for this opportunity, Chad. I really appreciate it, and I really think that, like you said, this is a safe space, and a safe space to laugh, a safe space to go, this sucks, you know, so I find that fantastic, so thank you for bringing us all together. As far as plugging, there's not really much to plug. You know, those that know me, I'm on the interwebs. Come and find me. Throw my name in. Try to figure out how to spell it. Google will correct you and probably have it in the right. So final thoughts on Jod Proudstar. In addition, like I said, there's so much to talk about. Good, bad, ugly, indifferent, all of it. You know, the unreached stars that, you know, he hadn't yet done in his character development. But that's endemic to all of it for me, unfortunately. You know, the comics and the portrayal of indigenous people, no matter which side of the border and no matter, you know, which part of the world, it's marginalized. It is not a great representation. As I said before, it doesn't do a great job of showing any of our humanity, any of the things that we see in each other when we go out and talk with our family, our community, and other Native people. So I'm absolutely looking for others like the people in this room and this podcast to make fantastic stories and to make sure that we overcome that stumbling block and don't repeat it. I'm seeing that more and more, and I'm very excited to see that.
Thank you. Marcy?
Well, I want to echo what Michael said. And thank you for this opportunity, Chad. It's always great to talk to you. We need to do it more often.
Yes, please.
And it's great to meet all of you that I have not met or haven't known before today. And it's always great to get together with other Native people and Native allies. Yeah, there's a lot that's problematic with Jod Proudstar, but I do think overall representation is getting better. I absolutely love Kahori in the Marvel What If series. If you guys haven't seen that yet, please go watch that. It was amazing. They spoke the Mohawk language. They got the traditions right. I didn't find one thing in all of her depiction that was hurtful or, you know, that made me go, oh, I wish that they hadn't done that or cringe or whatever. It was joyful. It was just amazing to see that depiction of a Native American character, a Native American superhero. And I loved at the spoiler alert, sorry if your audience hasn't watched all of them yet, but at the end where they go after the colonizers, that was my favorite part. So yeah, it's been bad, but it's getting better and I have hope for the future. And as far as plugging my own work, I do have a poetry chapbook that was published this past year. It's called Blood Quantum and Other Hate Crimes. I don't know if you guys can see the thing. It's by Fallen Tree Press, and it's all about indigenous, you know, my own indigenous experiences. Some of the poems in there are speculative. One of them won the Riesling Award last year. Two of them have been nominated for the Riesling this year. One of the poems has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize. So I'm pretty proud of it. I'm not really sure I have anything else coming out this year that I can talk about yet. Maybe in the fall. I am still on Facebook in that place that was once called Twitter, because that's where a lot of Native people are. I know a lot of people say, oh, don't be on those platforms. But like, when that's where your tribe is, like, that's where you're going to be. And I'm not going to apologize for it. But I'm also on Blue Sky. So, and I get a lot of engagement there. And so I talk to a lot there. So if you want to chat with me, come over to Blue Sky and say hi.
The one thing that we forgot to talk about John Proudstar, and I think the biggest sin for his creation, is that he's redundant. You know, he is, you know, he's got the attitude of Wolverine and Colossus is a strength and stuff. And so when it come down to, we need to lose a character, he's the easiest one to lose. And that's the real shame of it all. Reading assignments, I guess, for recommendations for people. If you've not seen Rich Hall's Inventing the Indian, it's a 2012 documentary. It's on YouTube. You can watch it. It really explains the mindset that came to the creation of Thunderbird. So all the, how Native American culture was portrayed and why it was portrayed such a way in cinema and television from the 20s on, or 10s on, actually. And so that's fascinating. And when we talk about humor, Michael mentioned, I do also want to point out, We Had a Little Real Estate Problem by Cliff Nesteroff. It's a great book about Native American comedy, and which most people don't know that's a thing, and it totally is. And Cliff does a great audiobook of it. I highly recommend it to listen to that. So you can find me at scottywhite.com. My next thing is Chronicles of Limbo number 3 is coming out. We're hoping to do the Kickstarter in May. Chronicles, like I said, is the story of a Native American. She's a half vampire and she has a cosmically powered toddler. I'm trying to write stories about natives that are in non-native spaces. You don't find us in space. You don't find us in fantasy. And I'm trying to put us in, you know, sci fantasy. So that's where you can find it. I have a Substack you can subscribe to on scottywhite.com, where I talk about my writing and stuff. So, and if you're in Mobile, come down to my game store, Gamers and Geeks. We'd love to have you.
Thank you. It's good to see you, John.
It's an honor, you know, to be involved in something like this, because the character had such an incredible effect on me. And thank you. Thank you for including me in on this. Yeah, and hopefully, you know, and I say great trepidation, I hope Marvel eventually gets it right. I wish they would call me so they could talk to me and we'll get it right together. But without those wacky Native characters in pop culture, you know, I don't know if Tribal Force would have been around. I don't know if the things that I've created came from all that, the good and the bad of it. You know, the good part you want to emulate, the bad part you want to, you know, make that correction. But thank you. Thank you for including me in on this. I'm very honored and very honored to be a part of this panel. Great people you got together. The upcoming projects I have, I'm doing a film with Eric Roberts and Danny Trejo called Last Bus. There's another film coming up, which I can't really say much about, but we're going to start shooting in April. Hopefully I'll get continued to be cast in other films. And I'm working diligently on Tribal Force Issue 3. So hopefully that'll be out in the next month or two. And you can find me on Facebook. That's probably the best, fastest way to get a hold of me. And I'm very interactive on Facebook. But thank you very much.
Thank you so much, John. And Ben.
Yeah, so this was really cool. Like I said, I haven't been in comics for a long time, but it was really nice to just kind of dive in a little bit more into the intricacies of a character and story. And I mean, I live for that stuff. So that was awesome. And the fact that John Proudstar is actually on this, I got some Muskegee, who are going to be very, very jealous of this fact. So that's awesome. This is nice to meet you, John. As far as me, I have a story that came out last year in an anthology. It's a continuation. I've been doing short stories using Bast and Fenrir, Gods Come to Life, in some rather humorous and comedic ways. Doing adventures around the world. I've done two stories with them in two different anthologies, kind of chaining them together. I'm looking at a third for this year. I have a story on the Pirate Queen of Kanat, an alternate timeline story that'll be coming out sometime in the summer. The Kickstarter is finishing up now. That will prove to be very interesting because my wife is Scots-Irish. And so she's not exactly related to Kate O'Malley, but it's definitely an interest for us. So that'll be a fun story to write. And then I'm also working with a couple of friends of mine in Canada to create another story about natives in space, looking at Exploring and colonizing new worlds, but using it as a vehicle to inspire STEM education in girls, usually roughly the tween to teenage years, especially those who are underrepresented in the education system. Also side work, I'm working on an RPG called Xenovita. It's based on the newly reimagined Renegade Legion universe. We've had a stall period because of other copyright issues that were going on. So that's been resolved. And so we're continuing moving forward with constructing an entire RPG from the ground up. That's been a lot of fun. And that will probably hit Kickstarter next year. This podcast is still around and you're listening to it in 2026.
It will be.
But as far as connecting with me, I'm kind of prolific on Blue Sky. I'm also very huge on LinkedIn, mainly for professional, but I also do a lot of interaction with writers and artists in that space as well. So you can find me best in both of those and just look up Ben H. Rome for that and you'll easily jump over. My website is benhrome.com. But
thanks, Ben. I'm sorry, I forgot to plug this and I really need to. I am working with Connor Alexander from the Coyote and Crow role-playing game. He has started a cultural consultation, several other Native American people. So people who are doing role-playing games or comics or other creative endeavors who want to have Indigenous elements in their work, they can come to us, get Indigenous people actually helping them to get things right. And if we aren't the right people to do it, then we can help them find the right people to do it. So yes, there you go, Scotty. Coyote and Crows. It's a great role-playing game. It funded very, very quickly, $1 million. It went over the $1 million threshold. So it's very, it's very popular. But I think it's a great endeavor because, you know, we're talking about Indigenous representation on this this whole panel. And this is an opportunity for people who want to include those things in their work and don't know how and don't want to get it wrong. Coyote and Crow website has all the information.
What an esteemed honor to have each of you here. It's been such a thrill to feature all Native talent, well, primarily Native talent and people who work with Native talent on the show this month as we explore this character. All of you are welcome on this show anytime. Anytime we're talking about Jean Grey or any other character from Mr. Sinister to Magneto, but it's been really wonderful to be able to connect with and amplify such creative, incredible talent through the show this month. What a huge honor. I'm just super grateful. And I'll be reaching out to some of you who'd like to come back and do another episode on a different character sometime. That would be a wonderful thing. I hope it's been very educational for everyone. And thank you all for connecting. The final episode of this month in March will be featuring Giant Size X-Men number 4 with Steve Orlando and David Cutler as my guests on that one. And then in April, we get to jump into new content. We're opening the month with script readings of that time that Beast joined the Avengers and that time that Angel and Iceman joined that weird team called the Champions with Hercules, Black Widow, and Ghost Rider on it. It's going to be a wild time, so everybody stay tuned. And watch over on the Patreon where we're doing focused character episodes all the time as well. Thank you, Michael, Scotty, Ben, John, and Marcy. What an incredible joy and honor to have you all here. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We will see you back here next time on the Grey Malkin Lane Show.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.